Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what we think of as a tour of the battlespace of the war for the free world. One of my partners in that exploration, of course, we hear from each week at this time. He is Fred Grandy, former member of Congress, former star of stage and screen, and now, I'm very pleased to say, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. We have been treated this week, Fred, to several very important hearings before the United States Senate, specifically a hearing involving Leon Panetta and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, about the Benghazi caper. Let's start with that. What did you make of the explanation that was given that the military really couldn't do anything about the attack that seemed to stretch out for about 7 hours? Senators seem to find it implausible. Do you?
Okay, absolutely. I can't believe that people at the senior level of Dempsey and Panetta could not have found some way to respond. I mean, F-16s are not gliders. They don't go without direction. And for Panetta to say, well, you can't just deploy F-16s. Well, if you've got a facility with an American flag under siege, isn't that a reason to deploy an F-16? Even if you just use it to scramble the crowd below, you don't necessarily have to engage. But that seemed to be a bridge too far. I have to tell you, though, Frank, more troubling to me was the fact that apparently, according to Panetta's own testimony, the president met with Panetta at 5 o'clock that afternoon and then couldn't be bothered for the rest of the night. I mean, before all of the serious stuff went down, the president has a meeting and essentially washes his hands of the whole thing. It sounds a lot like Pontius Pilate to me.
It does kind of. I was told that the president had to go off and do something concerning Israel. Is that clear what it was
he did? He called Benjamin Netanyahu to essentially try and patch up some political differences. But again, this was nothing more than a political call. And why that was more important than the lives of four Americans who are at an embassy facility in a hostile country is hard for me to believe. But well, obviously, we've been tracking this administration long enough to know that political considerations always trump national security ones.
Indeed, they do. Another interesting data point, Fred Grandy, was that Martin Dempsey expressed some surprise that Hillary Clinton seemed so unaware of the dire security situation, specifically of a memo that had been prepared in the month ahead of that terrible attack by the ambassador to Libya himself, the man, of course, who was among those killed when the attack went down. Did that strike you as plausible, Fred, that she would not have known about how anxious her ambassador was about the deteriorating situation there in light of the rising power of the folks that we had helped to bring to power, namely the jihadists?
Well, I think it's plausible if you take, and I do, the belief that all serious policy is crafted by a few in the president's inner circle, and it's conceivable that this memo even never got as far as the Secretary of State or the White House, and that the Joint Chiefs is merely just kind of, in an attempt to protect her, I think revealing one of the great flaws in how national security policy, and for that matter, pretty much all public policy, is conducted in the White House, which is yet again another reason not to confirm toadies like Chuck Hagel, probably John Kerry, and most definitely John Brennan.
Mm. Well, John Kerry, of course, has gotten through. I want to come back to Brennan in just a moment with you. Fred Grandy is our guest, of course. He is a senior fellow with the Center for Security Policy and a man we share this microphone with frequently and very pleased to do so. Fred, one other thing out of this Panetta hearing before we move on was the revelation that, in fact, there had been a plan advanced by the Pentagon, by the CIA, and by Hillary Clinton's State Department to arm the Syrian so-called rebels, opposition, whatever, jihadists, I think is the most accurate word for them, by and large. We're told that, as you say, this was turned down by the inner circle at the White House. We're not quite sure by whom. First of all, there's still, I think, an outstanding question as to why Christopher Stevens felt it so important to be in Benghazi on that particular day, September 11th, and to be meeting with the Turkish consul general, his last official act, if there weren't some sort of covert arms operation going on. But again, what about the fact that Hillary Clinton, when she appeared last month on these issues, professed complete unfamiliarity with any idea of arming the rebels through Turkey?
Well, all I can do, Frank, when I listen to these huge flaws in the testimony and the complete lack of consistent narrative among what you would consider to be the principal players in the policy-making apparatus of this administration, is that at this point, I think members of the administration who are outgoing and members who are staying are so convinced that the Senate really cannot get their act together to engage in serious questioning and conclusions and connecting the dots that their stories can remain inconsistent and they won't last longer than a 24-hour news cycle. And that, unfortunately, seems to be what the case is here. There's no question that what the president was trying to do with turning down any attempt to arm supposedly pro-democracy rebels in Syria, and who that group is, we still don't know, for purely political reasons. He'd established that al-Qaeda was on the ropes, and the last thing he was going to do was get involved in another conflict, regardless of what the consequences of not doing so would be.
Yeah. I have to say, and I'm going out on a limb on this, but my instinct tells me that the president may have had plausible deniability on this issue, but that there was something going on in that so-called special mission compound in Benghazi, and that the ambassador was there for a reason that had to do with those arms going into Syria. But we'll wait the judgment of history or at least further evidence on that subject. But Fred, before we move on, very quickly, one of the inner circle, the toady, as you called him, that did not get much of a grilling yesterday, at least on the issue that seems to me to have been the one that was most deserving of illumination, speaking to your point about the low standing of the Senate, jihad. John Brennan says it's all about personal struggle and purifying the community, and not a single member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, as best I can tell, challenged him on that point. What do you make of that?
That Brennan hearing was more about the interrogators than the person being interrogated. They were all up in arms about drone attacks and whether or not he leaked information. No matter how you feel about drones, that was nothing more than a political exercise. Those policies are in place. They're not going to change. And I don't think there is any chance in the world that Brennan will not be confirmed unless and until somebody draws blood over this jihadist issue. But I know you know the members of that panel as well as I do, Frank, on both sides. Who is concerned enough about the spread of jihad and the real meaning of jihad, as evidenced in Reliance of the Traveler and every Islamic scholar and leader since Muhammad, to make that point? I don't see them.
Yeah. Well, listen, we are going to be tracking this much, much, much further in the days ahead, because I think you're absolutely right, Fred. I think it's kind of the historic defect of our generation that we are not witting about the nature of the enemy we're confronting, and in fact giving a pass to those who are indulging in this kind of, what our friend Andy McCarthy calls willful blindness. Much in evidence in the hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. There's another one coming up.
It's a pandemic.
Indeed. There's another one coming up on Tuesday of next week in closed session. Doubt that that will get much more attention there, but we'll see what we can do in the meantime to stir the pot. Fred Grandy, as always, we appreciate so much your expertise and insights. We look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, stay well. Next up, we have Douglas Murray bringing us a view from the front in Europe on the rising tide of Islamism there and what it means for us here in Sudan.
Know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying we're serious about really cutting the budget
as a backdrop
to this debate about 2011. People make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC, New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of the people that I have enjoyed getting to know and follow as a leader in the fight against Islamism in the world. His name is Douglas Murray. He is one of the leaders of the Henry Jackson Society in Great Britain, a man that I had the privilege of working for, and I'm so delighted that he's being immortalized by an outstanding organization of which Douglas is a driving force. Douglas, welcome back. I think this is our first visit since the start of the new year. Happy 2013, such as it is.
Thank you very much, Frank. Great to be with you and your listeners again.
Well, it's a pleasure. Listen, we had a bit of happy news in the face of a very, very grim portent, namely our friend and colleague Lars Hedegaard literally dodged the bullet earlier this week in Denmark. And I wonder, as you look at this episode and the story of which it is clearly just a piece, Tell us what you make of it and what we should be thinking about it, not just in terms of our friends in Europe, but also what's coming here in the United States.
Well, this is an extraordinary story, and one which I'm amazed has not been given greater publicity in the mainstream press and media. Lars Hedegaard is a very prominent journalist in Denmark. He's 70 years old. He is a historian, author, journalist, and one of the leaders of an organization called the Free Press Association. He is a extraordinary freedom of speech campaigner. And a very well-known figure in Denmark. He's an adamant critic of radical Islam and has written about this for many years, and I think should be rewarded with the admiration of all decent people. However, the situation in all of our countries being what it is, Lars on Tuesday morning had a knock on his front door of his home in Copenhagen, and a man in his mid-20s, described as having a foreign appearance, gave him a package and then pulled out a gun and fired at his head from a yard distance. And the first bullet managed to just miss his head. Lars punched the man in the face, and the man dropped the gun, picked it up again, pulled the trigger again, and it jammed. And at that point, Lars managed to hit him again. The man ran off. It was a clear assassination attempt, and as such, I think should be understood as by everybody as an appalling attempt to silence and to bring down the Schaffegates on our right to free expression, not just in Copenhagen or in Denmark, but in Europe and the West, indeed the world generally. It's an absolutely appalling event, not, of course, the first in Denmark, not, of course, the first in Europe. Denmark's already seen assassination attempts on the people who drew the cartoons a few years ago that were published in Jyllands Posten. And, of course, we've seen assassinations that have, sadly, worked, both, of course, against the filmmaker Theo van Gogh in Holland in 2004 and against the politician Pim Fortuyn in 2002. There is an attempt to silence by intimidation and murder people who say things that are true. But I think that one of the most concerning things about this is the silence that we have heard since. This happened on Tuesday. It is Friday. There's been 3 days since, and I have been waiting for all of the free speech advocates, all of the people who say they defend journalists in their brave efforts to expose corruption and so on. I have been waiting for them to speak, and they have been silent. Utterly, utterly silent. And there's a reason. Because just as in the case of Theo van Gogh and just as in the case of Pim Fortuyn, people have looked at Lars, and some of the headlines where people have covered it have even said, Islam critic Lars Hedegaard has an assassination attempt. In other words, people are thinking, well, we probably don't like it very much, but let's face it, they've brought it upon themselves. This, I think, is a cross-section. It is a cross-section that shows the sickness of what is going on in our societies, where people who tell the truth and people who attempt to murder people who tell the truth, instead of simply condemning the people who would murder people, people stand back and think, well, the fact is maybe they shouldn't have spoken. This is the true problem.
Yes. Douglas Murray, let me just ask you to reintroduce another aspect of the Lars Hedegaard story, of course, again, from the perspective not simply of a colleague and a man who has similarly taken great and, I think, very courageous steps to expose your countrymen and the rest of us, not just in Great Britain, but around the world, to the dangers that clearly are being posed to us all by this rising tide of Islamism. But tell us about Lars Hedegaard's handling at the hands of his own government for some of this truth-telling.
Absolutely. You know, I checked, and it was 2 years ago, Frank, you and I were talking about the case of Lars Hedegaard as he was being put through a show trial in Denmark. And this is the way that this works. Lars Hedegaard was recorded by a journalist in his own house. He was misrepresented about what he'd said when he was talking about honor killings in the Muslim community, which go on in Norway and in Sweden and in Denmark and across Europe and all of the rest of the world. He was talking about this. He was recorded by the journalist, and a trial was put on of Lars Hedegaard in Denmark for this alleged hate speech. He was fined, he appealed, and he won the appeal. So he is not convicted of this thought crime, as I think of it. Lars Hedegaard, nevertheless, was reported in the papers in recent days as having been convicted. The BBC had to correct their story. The Guardian had not bothered to correct their story. But here you see the setup. In all of these problems that the whole world is going through, not just Copenhagen, the whole world, and the free world in particular, is going through the same problem. And there are people who are trying to pinpoint the problem by just talking about it, by just writing about it. And they are the subject of their government's concerns. They are the people who are being singled out. You know, if I now decided to say in London something deeply offensive to Muslims, I might be threatened with being put on some kind of trial. This is what is happening in all the free countries of Europe and the West. But if I stood up and said something about Lars Hedegaard, nothing would happen. Now, who is under the bigger threat in all of this? The critic of the Islamists or the Islamists themselves? It is the critics who are being put on trial. It is the critics who are being targeted. It is the critics who are right. And if we do not realize now the danger of the price of telling the truth, the danger that is being put to all people for the simple thing of telling the truth, if we do not realize what is at the end of that road, then we deserve what's coming.
Well, I fear that whether we deserve it or not, it's coming, that's for sure. And the failure to appreciate and brace up those who are telling the truth and to help them defend us all against this threat is, I believe, going to be a lasting indictment against most of the rest of our societies. But very quickly, as you know, Douglas Murray, and again, he is the associate director at the Henry Jackson Society and the author of most recently Bloody Sunday, Truths, Lies, and the Saville Inquiry. We are witnessing this week also the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, kind of the driving force behind a lot of this effort to suppress what they call blasphemy, now saying that this is not just Islamophobia that Lars Lettegar and Douglas Murray and others of us are engaged in. It's hatred of Islam, which justifies, under their Sharia doctrine, the sorts of attacks. Very quickly, Douglas, what should we make of that? What should we do about this OIC?
What we should do about it is tell them where to stick it. We should have no involvement in it. And it is a scandal that the Obama administration and that governments across the Western world are even talking to the OIC. You know, there are people in the world who hate people because of their race and much more. There are bigots out there. But when people try to make it illegal to tell an opinion about a religion, about, let's remember, a set of ideas, this is a very dark thing indeed. All religions and all sects of ideas should be available for critique. But what the OIC is trying to do is to make Islam beyond critique. That is to say, it would be illegal to say that the things that you would say if you are not a Muslim. It would be illegal to say that Muhammad made up the Quran.
We mustn't allow that to happen. Douglas, I have to let you go. I'm so sorry, but thank you for joining us. As always, it's great to visit with you. We hope to do so again very soon. Next up, Dan Garay will take us inside what's turning out to be a nightmare of sequestration. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Sanger.
I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh. I'm rich. Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit cards.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. When the history of this era is written, it likely will be an account of the failure of our government and elites to understand and contend with the rising threat of a totalitarian ideology Islamists call Sharia. If so, yesterday's Senate hearing on the nomination of John Brennan to become the next CIA director should be a case in point. Brennan was not asked a single question about jihad, the obligation under Sharia for its adherents to engage in holy war. He insists that term really just means personal struggle to purify one's community. We cannot afford to remain in a state of denial about the true nature of the Islamist threat we confront. Senators will be complicit in the dire historic consequences if they allow John Brennan to perpetuate that dangerous self-delusion. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted, and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit, make a plan, be informed today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Dan Gouray. He is a guy that I have come to admire tremendously for his expertise and his clarity of thought and his ability to articulate that clear thought to the rest of us about national security in general and specifically what's going on that will bear upon our future national security. He is the vice president of the Lexington Institute and truly a go-to guy for, I think, official Washington on issues involving particularly how in a resource-constrained environment we can ensure that the American people are not put unnecessarily at risk. And Dan, the evidence is continuing to accumulate now that the military services, amazingly enough, just in the space of the past month or so, have been allowed to do planning for what will happen if they have to take the sorts of cuts now in the pipeline and those in prospect. Give us, if you would, your reading on what sequestration in particular will mean in terms of our presence, our modernization, our maintenance of the force, training, and so on.
Well, thanks for having me on, Frank. Clearly, by the evidence proposed by the services, they've all put out now charts detailing the almost month-by-month effects of sequestration over this just this next year, you are going to see every one of the major areas of investment, people even, certainly equipment, operations and maintenance, infrastructure, and overseas operations, all take a massive hit. What we're going to see in the short term is an unbelievable degree of hollowness that's going to exceed anything we saw in the aftermath of Vietnam or as a result of the Clinton peace dividend. We're talking about dozens of ships, hundreds of airplanes, perhaps thousands of vehicles that will simply be parked because there will not be maintenance for them, fuel for flying, or qualified people to man them.
This is the sort of thing that, of course, in the abstract sounds bad, but let me ask you, as a guy who formerly ran the Office of Strategic Competitiveness in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Dan Gray, tell us what this translates into in terms of reduced presence of the United States military, reduced power projection capabilities, and what that implies for the world.
We're already seeing it. The military Pentagon just announced that it's going to reduce its presence, the aircraft carrier presence in the Persian Gulf, from 2 to 1. Now, that means very specifically that instead of being able to run full-day operations, 16-hour operations, 16 hours worth of operations, and only stopping for night, they're only going to be able to run 8 hours worth of operations. Well, any military person, let's say the Iranian Republican Guard, at a time when we're trying to put pressure on Iran, can look at this and say, wow, the U.S. military capability or threat that they may pose to us if we do something nasty in the Gulf just dropped by 50% or better. You think about North Korea about to run a nuclear test, having just done a missile launch, deploying a rogue mobile missile. We'll have fewer ships with anti-missile capability, the SM-3-equipped destroyers available in the Pacific if North Korea wants to do anything. This means we won't be there. We're likely not to be there when a crisis hits with forces that can, in fact, either deter or defend.
And again, as a student of history and a serious thinker about these kinds of matters, Dan Gray, does that, at least if history is any guide, indicate to you that you're likely to see more aggressive behavior being exhibited on the part of people who, like those you've mentioned, are already seemingly feeling their oats even before we start gutting the military?
The thing that historically, and certainly for the United States, since the end of World War II, that has kept aggression at bay, China, Korea, Soviet Union, Iran today, whatever, has been they're looking at the U.S. military presence and that of our allies and calculating that they cannot succeed through the use of force. Now they're going to re-examine those situations. You have a growing Chinese military. You have Iran investing in missiles, North Korea investing. And they're going to say, wow, our investment just doubled in value because the U.S. is bringing down its military, and therefore we might now be over the threshold where force will succeed.
Yeah. And Dan, again, having spent time in the Pentagon, I'm sure you have a sense of this, but for many of us, these sorts of issues are at best at some remove. We don't have loved ones who are serving in the military. We're not connected to the defense industrial base or live in a base community. So this is, as I say, something that may not touch our lives directly, even though it may threaten our lives, certainly if this trajectory runs the course you've described. What can you tell us that would help illuminate how the men and women in uniform who are asked to put their lives on the line for the rest of us are almost certainly perceiving what they're being asked to do and the way in which they're being asked to do it?
Well, they're clearly, we're hearing this anecdotally, we're reading this in surveys. They are clearly seeing what is going now as the word is breaking faith with them. Because for many of them, for all of them, it's not just a matter of the benefits they get here at home or the base housing or medical care. It is really the quality of the military training, equipment, and support that those that have to put their lives on the line receive. And when we're now saying the ships won't get maintained, the aircraft won't have flying hours, we're going to reduce the buys of ammunition, you may have to go into combat and there will not be another unit behind you to call on in the case of an emergency. They know that the risk is increasing, and it's not, I'm sure for more and more of them, it's not clear that this is something for which they wish to sacrifice.
Yeah. You know, a very practical aspect of this was brought home to me in a report the other day. It was I think, on NPR, and it was kind of just a glancing mention of this, but I thought to myself, my God, how must these men and women be feeling? It was about one of the carriers that were about to deploy to the Gulf. I think it was the Harry Truman, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, with less than a week to go, they were being told to stand down. And the mention was made of the folks who may have leased their homes or their apartments and all of the arrangements they've made that are now knocked into a cocked hat. What does this do for the morale of those we asked to protect us if they're being treated in this kind of fashion? And again, what is that likely to mean in terms of the future viability of our armed forces, Dan Gray?
Great question. First of all, it not only impacts the morale of the individuals in uniform, but of the entire family. And in many cases now, this is an all-volunteer army, or military rather, we're talking about, you know, families, multiple generations who are serving or at least have served. This is, you know, now almost a family business in many cases. So the ripple effects are enormous. Secondly, it discourages massively people from staying in, the junior and mid-level people that we rely on, and it dissuades people in the future from joining up. And this not only affects the active duty force, the carriers are manned by active duty personnel, but it affects the Guard and Reserve. We get a large number of Guards and Reserves from the active force. Well, you now look at this, and why would I leave the active and retain my position in the Guard and Reserve if I'm going to be treated this way? And for a guardsman, why go in? Why would be a new guardsman if you cannot even predict with any reasonableness what kind of a situation you're going to have or what to do with your house, your possessions, your dog, your family.
I appreciate so much you bringing this down to that kind of level so that I hope all of us can relate and appreciate that this is not only a hardship, this is almost certainly going to be a powerful disincentive to these folks to stay in, which brings us, and we don't have time to discuss it today, but I hope you'll come back to us again soon, Dan Gray, to the question of whether we're going to find ourselves obliged, having broken the all-volunteer force, to return to a draft, and whether women will be obliged to sign up as well. That's for another day. Dan Gray of the Lexington Institute, thank you so much for the work you do there and for joining us from time to time. I hope we'll do a lot of it in 2013. In the meantime, be well. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Gertz. We'll get his take on the latest evidence of the U.S. government perhaps arming the Syrian jihadists. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express Travel Service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to the Gospel.
I just got
to
stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom, it's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're joined, as we are each week at this time, by our friend Bill Gertz. He is a senior editor for the Washington Free Beacon and the author of the superb Inside the Ring column in the Washington Times. Bill, let's start with some of the reporting you've been doing about the hearings that have taken place. We talked a bit earlier in the program with Fred Grandy about it, but I'd like to get your take specifically on the Panetta Dempsey hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and your takeaway about this this business about arming the Syrian rebels or jihadists.
Yeah, it's a very important story. This is kind of the backstory that a lot of the news media have failed to really focus on. The question being, what was the CIA doing in Benghazi? They had a complex about a mile away from the diplomatic compound that was attacked. Both were attacked on September 11th, but that really hasn't come out. What did come out was that during the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, questions of Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Panetta, the defense secretary, was, did you support a plan to arm the Syrian rebels? And they said yes. And apparently there was a covert action plan drawn up by the CIA and promoted by the State Department and supported by the Pentagon that would have armed the rebels. And the president rejected it. My question is, were the CIA personnel in Benghazi, in a sense, doing an end run on that formal covert action process and supplying arms to the Libyans who were then shipping them to the Syrian rebels? It's problematic, of course, because the rebels are infiltrated heavily with al-Qaeda and other Islamist figures.
You know, your instincts are the same as mine on this, but Bill, I was saying to Fred earlier that there may have been sort of an effort made after the White House ostensibly turned this plan down. And by the way, Hillary Clinton, according to your reporting, was also knowledgeable about this, despite the seeming, if implausible, denial of any understanding or awareness of a effort to arm the Syrians through Turkey that she expressed during her last hearing before the Foreign Relations Committee. But Bill, I guess what I was struck by was we still haven't had an explanation of what the so-called special mission compound was about in Benghazi. You've mentioned the CIA annex that was nearby, but what was that compound there for? And most especially, Bill, do we have a better read on why it was on September 11th of all days, Ambassador Stevens saw fit to be in that compound?
A lot of unanswered questions. You know, I think that what's really needed is a special congressional investigation of this to get all the facts out on the table. It's clear also that, you know, Hillary Clinton was not being honest about it. You know, she was asked during her recent testimony about this, and her response about what the CIA was doing was, I'll see what information is available. She was questioned by Senator Rand Paul on this, and we didn't get a good answer. McCain was on Fox News last night, asked about what was the CIA doing there, and his answer was he didn't know. And here he was, a senior member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he doesn't know. So there's clearly a need for a major congressional investigation. I think the Republicans need to press that.
A select committee to really drill down on it. I tend to agree with you at this point. I think it's clear it's not going to come out any other way. Bill, let me ask you about the Brennan hearing. I don't know about you, but I was really struck by the fact that no one on that committee saw fit to inquire at all about John Brennan's astonishing statement that jihad just means personal struggle and purifying your community. It has nothing to do with holy war. The question I guess I have, and you've done a lot of work over the years, including numerous books on the agency, about the extent to which politicization of the intelligence community is a real problem. Does this worry you in that regard, and shouldn't it worry the Senate?
Yes. You know, I mentioned this in my column today about the fact that this is what Brennan should have been questioned about, and not a single question came up from the senators on this. They clearly didn't do their homework. It was mainly focused on drone strikes and terrorist detainee policy, when in fact Brennan is the main propagator of this extremely nefarious policy of not fully identifying the strategic enemy in the war on terrorism, that is Islamist extremists. And clearly that's got to be something that's changed if we're ever going to win this war on terror.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. Bill Gertz is referring to his column in the Washington Free Beacon, and it's really required reading. Bill, one other drama on Capitol Hill with tremendously important implications for the national security, which is, of course, your extraordinary beat. And your colleague Adam Credo has been doing especially good work on this, I have to say. The Hagel nomination, is it your assessment, based upon his refusal to provide information about foreign sources of funding for speeches and the content of those speeches, that nomination is now essentially dead in the water?
No. In fact, Levin is digging in his heel, Carl Levin being the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and is demanding planning to have a vote in the near future on this. which will set up a further conflict with the Republicans. The Republicans have demanded that Hagel disclose his involvement in foreign organizations and funding from foreign groups, and he's refused to do it. It kind of reminds me of the Henry Kissinger refusal to disclose his foreign clients as one reason that he backed off being on a 9/11 commission many years ago. This is an extremely important matter. If the defense secretary is going to have foreign funding ties, those ties have to be exposed. And if he refuses, they should block the nomination.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm hoping that the Republicans who signed a letter, I believe, circulated by the new and very, very promising Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, to the effect that this request for such information is really required, including some like John McCain and Roy Blunt, who've up to this point said they would not support a filibuster, means that they would under these circumstances. We'll be watching that closely, as I know will you. Bill Gertz, two other quick items. One is Leon Panetta, in kind of his swan song speech at Georgetown University this week, made a very stern warning about the threat of a cyber Pearl Harbor with the capacity to destroy not only our electrical grid, but our country. You've been warning about this for a long time. Any sense that this is now beginning to get serious, focused attention?
Well, we had the recent reports that the U.S. Cyber Command is going to increase the number of cyber warriors from several hundred to several thousand. But, you know, there are still huge legal problems preventing the U.S. government from effectively dealing with cyber attacks. The legal authorities are not there. They need legislation, and it needs to be done right away. So we've had a lot of people crying about this threat, and it is getting worse. The problem is the U.S. government is not responding to it. So, in effect, we are really in danger of having another cyber 9/11 or cyber Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. Bill, and finally, one-minute burst, if you would. You wrote in the Inside the Ring column this week about a warning from a senior Navy intelligence official about China's increasingly hegemonistic policies in the Pacific. Quick burst on that.
Sure. This was a speech given in San Diego about a week ago by Captain Jim Fennell. He's the Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet based out in Hawaii. And it was a very blunt warning that China is using bullying tactics, military aggressiveness, and civilian proxies to try to threaten and bludgeon Asian countries into submitting to Chinese claims of wide areas of ocean waters. This is a big problem, and he is really should be credited for blowing the whistle on that.
Well, I hope it's something that he will be credited for rather than punished for, which seems more likely, I'm afraid. Bill Gertz, we have to let you go. Thank you very much, as always, for joining us and for your insights. The work you do at the Washington Free Beacon and the Washington Times is extraordinary and very, very, very much appreciated by us. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week and to talking with the rest of you again, I hope, as well next week. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.